Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi there, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Before we get started today, I'd just like to let you know about Streetwise Hebrew for the Times of Israel community. These are bite-sized audio Hebrew classes that we think you'll really enjoy. A little bit more about that at the end of today's podcast. Today is Thursday, October 7th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. Joining me here today are Times of Israel founding editor David Horowitz and Ops and Blogs editors Miriam Hirschlag. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Jessica.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. David, we're going to get started with you this morning. A little bit of COVID news. So there's the decline, or seems to be a decline in this latest coronavirus wave. And there are some developments that seem positive. We also have Prime Minister Naftali Bennett saying that he wants the government to end this era of uncertainty and come up with different kinds of solutions, particularly related to kids in school. We've got a bunch of stories up on the site right now. Do us a favor and relate to some of them and let us know where we are.
Okay. Hi, everybody. The big picture seems to be, I mean, we're all so wary after so long of being, you know, revealed as misassessing. But the big picture, according to the experts, the Director General of the Health Ministry, among them, is that what is known in Israel as the fourth COVID wave is waning. You can see it in many of the statistics. We're now below 500 serious cases. The number of active cases, which is also something that we highlight in our little module on the homepage, has been dropping and dropping quite fast for, I would say a few weeks even, but certainly in the last few days, you see it's down. It sounds like a lot, 33,000. It was way, way down, but it had been many tens of thousands higher. The death toll, we should be aware of this. This was a central factor when the Knesset opened this week and Bennett and his predecessor Netanyahu went at it. Netanyahu basically blamed Bennett for delaying the third booster shots and therefore causing in excess of 1,000 deaths. We could and they will argue this forever. But the fact is that the death toll has been rising in Israel quite alarmingly, I would say, because you had months in the summer when there was almost no fatalities, and we've had 2 months in a row of around 500 or more. So that's, you know, that's a pretty discouraging statistic. Big picture seems to be good, relatively speaking. We have had the curious situation of the Prime Minister quite deliberately picking fights with his health officials. When I say quite deliberately, you know, he semi-picked an open fight in his speech at the UN last week when he said words to the effect of, you know, doctors can't be setting the agenda, it's only the Prime Ministers who can do so. And that was a passage he added to the speech at the last moment. And then he told reporters separately who are with him about his defying, really, of health professionals who wanted, he said, more lockdowns. And he's decided, no, we battle through without lockdowns. It's very curious. And it's continuing. I think he wants this as his success. You know, his battle against Netanyahu when Netanyahu was prime minister was that Netanyahu was mishandling it. And he wants to be able to say that he beat COVID, where I think, you know, a few months ago, most Israelis would have said Netanyahu played a key personal role because he was so central to the vaccination process. And maybe just one more thing that I'll talk about. You talk about material on the site at the moment. So, yeah, there were two very interesting studies, Israeli studies, that came out late last night. One is more data than was previously collated showing how clearly the antibodies that you get from being vaccinated fall away after around 6 months. This is not a new assessment. It's central to the fact that Israel moved to the third shots and that so many other countries are doing so or thinking about doing so. But there was more data showing this. And then a really huge study of 2.5 million people vaccinated in Israel that I'll tell you the numbers. The risk of heart inflammation, you know, after COVID, which is something that has worried people, incredibly minor according to this data, afflicted only 0.002%, the risk of heart inflammation. And of those, only 2% developed serious cases. There was one fatality. So, you know, nothing is perfect in the world. But as regards this vaccine and the consequent risk of heart inflammation, this study indicates the risk is, you know, spectacularly small.
Okay, so I'll be the glass half full person and say that is reassuring. On to a very different subject, Miriam, Iran. Let's talk about one of the site's top op-eds right now relating to the Biden administration's emphasis for its preference for diplomatic efforts to revive the Iran nuclear agreement over military action. You have a blog post with a very strong take on what Israel's position should be regarding the U.S. strategy. Tell us about it, please.
Yeah, that's right, Jessica. Look, whatever objections Israel's government may have to the U.S. strategy of diplomacy, Prime Minister Bennett and his colleagues do seem committed to not raising a public ruckus over it. According to Professor Ephraim Inbar, this quiet on Israel's part is a grave mistake. Inbar is president of the Hawkish Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, which, in their words, promotes a conservative strategic worldview. In a post titled, "Israel Must Actively Oppose U.S. Return to the JCPOA," Inbar argues that even if Bennett's government is staying quiet for appearances' sake, its silence on the nuclear deal poses numerous threats to Israel's security. Inbar, of course, views the agreement itself as catastrophically bad. But his point is that just negotiating on a return to the agreement is dangerous because it gives the Iranians more time, even as their centrifuges spin away. Among the points that held my attention was his claim that the change in Israel's position jeopardizes Israel's diplomatic achievements in the region. He writes that Israel's vociferous opposition to the nuclear accord, mainly under Benjamin Netanyahu, earned Israel great support in Arab capitals, and the Abraham Accords are largely a result of Israel's stubborn stance against the Obama administration on the matter. So regardless of where you are on the policy, the piece is cogent, it's well argued, and it enriches the conversation on this critical and possibly existential question.
David, back to you for a second. President Yitzhak Herzog attended a ceremony in Kiev yesterday to remember the victims of the Babi Yar massacre, which was 80 years after one of the most infamous Nazi mass slaughters of World War II. Fill us in a little bit about that and your thoughts. There's a couple of pieces about it, about the event on the site right now.
Yeah, there's some. First of all, the ceremony itself is a big deal. It was this incredibly scarring and terrible event, and somehow, maybe to some extent, was maybe under the radar is too strong, but it's certainly being highlighted now, including in ways that are unprecedented, because a documentation has also come out, testimonies of Nazi officials who were involved. And we had this on the site as well yesterday or the day before, I think, when it first came out. And the few quotations are just, they're just unbelievably callous and specific. I've actually been to Babi Yar. I went there not that long ago. I interviewed Zelensky. You know, plainly, Ukraine under his leadership is charting a course certainly warming its ties with Israel, dealing with the Holocaust in a candid and sensible way. There were three presidents there yesterday, Steinmeier, Zelensky, and Herzog. They together dedicated a memorial, which is still in construction. And you can imagine all the sort of politics and the angst that goes into these kinds of things. You know, they've made progress towards this. They haven't finished building this. And there's been a lot of back and forth about what this should memorialize. There seems to have been a solution there. So lots of good intentions, it seems to me, coalescing around one of the many awful sites of Holocaust crime.
This Times of Israel podcast is brought to you by Koren Publishers Jerusalem. Whether you're looking to enrich your mind or your soul, Koren Publishers has it all. From Israeli history to the works of Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Steinsaltz, and other contemporary thinkers, including the brand new Magamon edition Koren Tanakh, with translation by Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, Jessica Sachs, and many others. Times of Israel listeners can get 10% off your entire order. Just go to korenpub.com and use the code TOIPOD, that's KORENPUB.com, and enter the code TOIPOD for your 10% discount.
On a very different note, back to you again, Miriam. You've got something by our resident Moel blogger. Tell us a little bit about that, and what kind of fun things are we reading in that piece?
Well, it's a response, actually, to a piece by Gary Steingart, who is an acclaimed Soviet-born American Jewish writer. He's the author of satirical bestsellers, including Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story. Steingart just wrote a long New Yorker article, or should I just say a New Yorker article, called A Botched Circumcision and Its Aftermath, about the results of a poorly performed bris he underwent at age 7. He was left with problematic residual tissue that's caused him untold psoris. The piece is quite, shall we say, specific about, shall we say, his penis. It also presents quite a few historical ideas about circumcision that notably quotes from Maimonides, the Rambam, who suggested that a great benefit of circumcision is to decrease sexual pleasure, which, So Rabbi Chaim Leiter, as you mentioned, a Mohel living and working in Israel, has a blog post today called The New Yorker's Botched Circumcision Article. He offers contrasting data that attests to the safety of the Brit Milah ritual for baby boys. And he brings counter narratives about the Maimonides quote and the issue of sexual pleasure. In his conclusion, he writes, "No one wants Gary Steingart to suffer another moment. And in truth, I commend him for sharing his experience so candidly, but his grievances are not with Brit Milah itself, but rather with the Soviet government. His struggles most likely resulted from his family's inability to give him a Brit Milah at 8 days when the recovery is quickest and easiest." It's certainly worth a read. And if you haven't received the link to the New Yorker article, chances are you will, because it's really making the rounds. Actually, I will follow up with just one more recommendation, and that's by another rabbi, Menachem Bamback. He's an educational entrepreneur in the Haredi community, and it's called Thou Shalt Love Your Child Who Leaves Religion, addressing a painful issue in any family where a kid chooses a different path. Many families in the Haredi world decide that continuing to accept and express love to such a child will be misread by the child and also by the community as an endorsement of the decisions they've made. And Rabbi Bamback writes in what I find to be a beautiful piece, one that's being very widely shared. He writes that just as God accepts us despite our weaknesses, so too we must accept our children in their new ways of life. We are commanded to do the best we can. After that, it is not our responsibility. A lovely post, getting a lot of traction, and I do recommend it.
It is a very lovely piece. Okay, so David, you challenged me. I'm going to bring myself in here right now regarding the Ophir Awards, Israel's Oscars, which were awarded in a ceremony on Tuesday night. There's a bit of a kerfuffle there regarding politics and the winning film, Let It Be Morning, by the director Eran Koliran, based on a Sayed Kashua novel. Eran Koliran is the director who also is known for The Band's Visit, an award-winning film that also made it to Broadway. This film is a Palestinian family drama about a middle-class Arab family who have settled in Jerusalem away from their family up north. When they go home for a family wedding, they get stuck on their way back to Jerusalem because of an unexplained army enforced lockdown, which forces the father of the family to reassess his Palestinian identity. So two of the main actors in this film are Palestinian, living in Germany, and they did not attend the screening that first took place in Cannes in France back in July because they wanted to protest the film's classification as Israeli and not Palestinian. They attended the Haifa Film Festival, which was last month, September, because it was in front of a mixed Arab and Jewish audience. Those two actors did not come to the Ophir ceremony this week because they do conveniently live abroad, but they did have their speeches read at the ceremony. And one of the Palestinian actors who lives here did attend, and in his speech, he called for a Palestinian state, not explicitly, but certainly in the speech. So given all of this, and given that the Ophir win for best film generally becomes the Israel contender for Israel's Oscar nominee for best foreign film, the question is whether Israel will choose Let It Be Morning, Will that chance be taken that more politics might end up dominating the event? And if it does, what will happen in that situation? So we'll certainly keep on following that story and seeing what happens with it. David, did you want to say something about that?
I mean, the culture... In previous years and previous governments, especially when Miri Regev was the culture minister, I think the outcry already would have been much greater. And in fact, there is, you know, there is lots of criticism coming from opposition politicians. But the current culture minister, Hilly Tropper, actually spoke at the ceremony and was robust in his defense of freedom of speech. So my question really for you is, I was not aware that it's not, you know, essentially automatic. Is there any realistic prospect that this will not be Israel's Oscar nominee?
Not really, but they don't ever say that it's automatic because it is not Israel. In other words, it's Israel can put forth their film and obviously then the Oscars and Academy Awards committee make their decisions about if it's even nominated. But there is still that chance that they could say this is not the nominee. It seems incredibly unlikely, but they always do hold on to that possibility. That's
what do you think the chances are that Miri Regev will object to it being, regardless of the fact that she's no longer the culture minister?
I'm sure she'll object, Miriam. The question is whether she can. She doesn't. No minister has the right to. Who has the right to stop it?
Right. Exactly. Neither of them do. Although she often, you know, as we all know, she would put her foot forward and try to stick her nose in.
Right.
Wherever
I mean, we've
she
had
could.
Some really. We've had some very interesting Oscar nominations. We really have. Israel's never won the foreign film Oscar. Right. And I mean, Israel's never won. I mean, Waltz with Bashir should have won, you know, every Oscar that it was for which it was available. In my humble opinion, I should stress. Foxtrot was pretty controversial, and I thought was an amazing movie. I wonder if this might be a popular choice, whether or not it's at the standard of those earlier movies.
I'm not sure it is. I mean, the last Israeli film to make it as a nominee for Best Foreign Film was Joseph Cedar's Footnote. Right. So that's actually also, a while back.
Which was when was that?
I'm going to say close to 10 years ago.
Wow.
It's a while back.
Gosh. The time flies.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting thing because Israelis tend to, when we don't win, we tend to accuse the judges of anti-Semitism. So here, if we do win, we can also make that accusation, which is always convenient.
Right. Always have that leg to stand on. All right. Well, that's it for today, folks. I'm going to put another word in about Streetwise Hebrew, our monthly event for the Times of Israel community with Guy Charet, who is a phenomenal Hebrew speaker, linguist, teacher. You basically learn colloquial Hebrew phrases around a common theme. This is not your traditional Hebrew course or Olpan, but it is for community members only. And with that, we say good day to you all and see you at our next daily briefing, and we have Times Will Tell, our weekly feature, coming up on Friday. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jessica. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And, of course, on thetimesofisrael.com.